Thank you, Ron, and good morning, everyone, and welcome to NFA's workshop here in New York. It's great to see everyone in person again. Again, my name is Joe McCarthy. I work in NFA's External Affairs and Communications Department. Just going to run through a few quick things for today's event. First, just a quick look at our agenda. You also received an email yesterday afternoon with this agenda and links to the slide decks that will be provided, so I encourage you to pull that up on your phone. And like Ron mentioned, those archived versions will be available on NFA's website in the coming days. You'll notice we'll have a break after our first two sessions and then a lunch before wrapping up with two sections, and we should be out of here around by 3 p.m. Like Ron mentioned, we're hoping to keep the workshop today as constructive as possible with good dialogue. So thank you for joining us. I encourage you to ask questions to the NFA staff joining us today. Ron mentioned again that we'll have a session dedicated Q&A time following each session. We'll answer as many questions as time allows. Happy to follow up with you either outside or in the coming days. And also, you could always find the NFA's Information Center. Contact information is here. You can also find it online should you have any questions following today's workshop. I mentioned the slide decks were circulated in an email, but again, you'll be able to find those online following the workshop. But if you have any would like to see the slide decks during the presentations, I encourage you to pull up that email. And then lastly, like Ron mentioned, we'll have archived versions of these presentations available online, and I encourage you to share those with your colleagues if they were unable to join us today. So we'll keep moving along here with our first session. I'll ask my colleagues Cheryl Tolino and Jonathan Flanagan to kick us off with the futures exam process and common exam finding session.
All right, thank you. All right, thank you, Joe. Well, welcome everyone to the workshop today. I'm going to be kicking off the first session to talk about the examination process. And I thought it would be best to first start before on how we select which exams we're going to examine. And the way we do this is we schedule and complete examinations in accordance with the guidance from the CFTC. And there's really three ways that we go about doing this. The first way is that certain firms need to be scheduled and completed on specific time frames. For example, CFTC's financial and SEG interpretations 4.1 and 4.2 require us to complete omnibus FCMs within 9 to 15 months or 9 to 18 months. Also, newly registered independent introducing brokers need to be completed with independent introducing brokers, need to be completed within 6 months if audited financial statements are not filed with us. The second way that we go about scheduling exams is with the assistance of our risk management group, which we commonly refer to as RMG. They use a risk-based approach, and they use quantitative and qualitative risk metrics to help prioritize which exams we should be examining. Some of the things that they may look at is the date of the last exam, what the findings from the last exam were, if there was any customer complaints that came in, information that they might have gathered during financial filings or any other filings that the firm made, or any prior disciplinary action that that there is. The last way that we schedule exams is if there's a person or a group of people within NFA that we schedule exams, is if there's a person or a group of people within NFA that see something that deems further investigation is warranted. For example, if numerous customer complaints come in about a specific area, it may be referred to the exam team to look into that area. Or a financial analyst, maybe they see something weird or unusual within the financial statements that needs to be further investigated, and then that would be referred to the examination group. Those are really the main three ways that we go about scheduling the exams, which then RMG would inform the exam manager which exams should be scheduled, and I'll coordinate with my team to determine how to best go about this. Usually it's for another staff, really anyone on the team, contacting the firm about 4 to 6 weeks in advance. They will call them. They will tell them the projected start date of our examination. They will also go over the operations call, try to schedule that out. And we will then follow up with an email. And in that email, we'll typically send out a pre-examination questionnaire or an internal controls questionnaire at time for you to complete and return back to us. We'll also request some other documents, maybe some supervisory procedures, maybe more recent financials than what's filed with us, maybe pool financials if it's a CPO, really anything that the team would deem to be relevant, potentially even an examination report from another regulator, really anything that the team deems relevant at our discretion. But the vast majority are announced. That leads us to the operations call. That tends to happen a few weeks before the exam starts. I like to have someone that's registered as an associated person and listed as a principal present during that call. They're, of course, free to invite whomever they like during that call. And typically, we see a lot of the key people at the firm attend those meetings. But really, just I like to have the AP and principal present. During that call, it'll be generally a high-level overview of the firm's operations, and we would also like to discuss any changes that may have occurred since the last exam. And while it's generally a high-level conversation, there may be and probably will be some specific and targeted questions based on the information that you've already provided thus far. After we have that operations call and start reviewing those documents, then my team will gather, we'll figure out the different risks that we see associated with the firm's operations, and then try to develop scopes around those risks. Some of the way that we identify risks and develop those scopes are, again, based on the information that you provide within your filings. It might be based on what was reviewed in the prior examination, what the prior examination found. It could be any sort of regulatory initiatives that there are, any new NFA rules or CFTC regulations that have come out since the last examination. And that really helps drive our initial scopes. But those scopes are really just the initial band in scopes, and scopes can be modified as the examination progresses. But that is basically how we develop those initial scopes. And then once we have those initial scopes, we'll be able to prepare an initial document request list that we can send out to the firm. Ideally, it's sent out about a week in advance. We will do our best to tailor it to the firm's operations and tailor it to the scopes that we've identified and the risks that we identified and the scopes that we built around them. Within there will also be instructions to our regulatory filing system, which is a secure file sharing site. And it can be accessed by the ORS Securities Manager. And this is really the medium which we rely on firms to provide us documents. So everything that the exam team requests and that you provide should be uploaded to this regulatory. So everything that the exam team requests and that you provide should be uploaded to this regulatory filing system. It's really important to keep this as organized as possible. We will do our best to create folders that mirror the initial document request list to help keep this organized. But if the member firms do upload everything in an organized way, it does help the exam be a little bit more efficient. RFS also has some additional features in place that some teams utilize, such as tracking requests and due dates. This brings me to the examination itself. And now, for the most part, where we are today, almost all exams have some sort of on-site component. Almost all exams have some sort of on-site component. There will be, in some rare occasions, where there's just a virtual examination done. But if you're called for an exam, I would almost expect that there'd be, you should expect that there'd be some sort of on-site component. That on-site component has changed over the years. Pre-pandemic, we were probably here, we were probably at the firm the first day. Whereas now, we usually take a couple of days, review the documents, kind of get a sense on the different questions that we want to ask. That way, when we go to the firms, they can be more meeting-driven. We can interview some key personnel, review the internal controls at the firm, maybe have a walkthrough and a demonstration of the systems that are in place at the firm, and really observing the supervisory processes that are at the firm. I'm not really planning on getting into a framework. Now, even on-site, even firms that we do on-site, there's definitely going to be virtual meetings. There's virtual meetings in every single exam that we do. Our preferred method of having those meetings is definitely through Teams and Zoom, things like that, just because it has the video capabilities, has the file share, the screen sharing capabilities as well. It could, just could help meetings, depending on what is being discussed in the meetings, it could sometimes be very beneficial to you to use those type of services. A couple other things to hit on with the examinations is, I said when we before we start the exam, we have an initial document request list. It's a comprehensive list, but you will be receiving more requests throughout the examination. I would say that the first few weeks or months, the amount of requests will definitely be a little bit more frequent than the middle stage of it. And then towards we get, and then as we approach the latter part of the exam, it'll probably pick up a little bit just as we're trying to wrap up the examination itself. Also, as we try to, as we identify any deficiencies or anything that requires corrective action in the exam, the exam team will try to let you know as early as possible on the exam. It's really important that this gets addressed right away, just because for the most part, our exams do not get closed until that corrective action has been completed. This leads me towards the end of the exam process. And when I think about the end of the exam process, I usually think that now we're doing the exit interview. During the exit interview, I also like to have someone that is ready. During the exit interview, I also like to have someone that is registered as an AP and listed as a principal present. Once again, they can invite whomever they wish to attend that meeting. And in there, we'll have a overview of what was tested. We will try to summarize the findings, really everything that you should already know during the exam, and discuss the whatever is open and any sort of corrective action that still needs to be completed. And we'll try to give you some sort of time frame so you could gauge when you can expect the examination report to be received. We're required to give the exam reports within 150 days. Hopefully it's well before then, but by day 150, and they will be sent to someone that is registered as an associated person and listed as principal. Ideally, I always try to give it to the person. Once again, if you would like more people to receive that, you could just inform us and we will make sure that they are CC'd within the email as well. And that will be sent, generally it will be sent by the office manager. So it's not by someone on the exam team, but it'll be sent by the one of the office managers and it'll be sent securely. And you should have some sort of idea of when to expect to receive it. If you have any issues opening up the report or accessing in the report, definitely reach out to the exam team. And they may be able to help you out, figure out how to open up the document or even some other alternative method to retrieve the document. Most reports indicate that a response is required. If it is required, it'll indicate it in the report, and the due date will be in the report as well. And then for each finding that is in the report, you should discuss the circumstances that led to the finding, any corrective action that you have taken, as well as any changes to the controls to make sure that this doesn't happen again in the future. And then really, once we receive the report and all the corrective action has been completed, then we could go ahead and close the exam in our system. That really concludes and summarizes the examination process. Now I'm going to turn it over to Cheryl where she can discuss some of the common exam findings.
Okay, hello everyone. So now that John's gone through the exam process, I'm going to go through changes in the industry. So I'm going to start with registration. Typically, we routinely find that firms are not listing all principals. Principals are individuals merely by their title or direct ownership in the firm, but you also need to remember that indirect ownership of the holding company or the parent company, greater than 10%, also requires to be registered as a principal. Associated persons, these are pretty much your sales force. The individuals that are dealing with customers and orders need to be APs. I think we see more often the AP area that's forgotten the most is anyone in the direct line of supervision of an associated person also needs to be registered as an associated person. That one can be forgotten a lot. And then any area, location where an AP works out of the main office needs to be a branch office. Now, granted, this has changed since the pandemic, since we now have this remote location category, which is where an individual, pretty much it's when they're working from home, that they're working at a location that doesn't hold itself out as a member or, you know, the company's name. They're working from their home. They're not having customer interviews there. Those offices still need to be reviewed and supervised. I'll get into that later. But those don't need to be listed as a branch office. The ones where business activity takes place, rented offices, groups of individuals working, that's a branch, and that location would need to be listed with us. Now I'll move to the CPO-CTA ratios. Also very common deficiency that we find for various different reasons. Please remember that these ratios are to get an assessment of the financial situation, condition of the firm, not the pools. So these should be completed using financial information for the firm. Revenue expenses need to be for the preceding 12 months. So if you're doing a 331-23 PQR, you're using financial information back till April of 2022. Using the accrual basis of accounting, you cannot use cash accounting when preparing your financial statements. So please use the accrual also when you're doing it for the CPO. And maintain support. You need to maintain evidence and records for these because when we do come to examine, or you can get a phone call from the group that analyzes these statements quarterly asking questions, and you should have the support to show how you came to these numbers. Next is pool financial reporting. So this is, you know, the account statements that are provided to participants. They are either sent monthly or quarterly based on the type of fund that you operate, and in some, you know, that can even do quarterly. Many firms choose to still send monthly. If and when you do that, the statement should include information for the pool as a whole, not just the participant. That information needs to be on there as well, whether showing their NAV or showing their NAV per unit. That information needs to be on there as well, whether showing their NAV or showing their NAV per unit. But the financial statement should be prepared for the pool of itself. We often find that these statements are missing various components in that area. And then they also need to be signed, including an oath and affirmation, with certain criteria underneath the oath. And the last thing I'll point out is just the 30-day deadline. These account statements are supposed to be provided to participants within 30 days of the month or quarter end. Also in the area of CPOs, if your pool is operating pursuant to an exemption that isn't like a quick hit right out of the gate, you have this exemption and you're good. If you do the de minimis, or if you have participants, you have a 4-7 exemption because your participants are qualified, you need to keep evidence of this. Records that show your participants qualify financial information to show that you are members, that show your participants qualify financial information to show that you are staying beneath the de minimis to keep this exemption. Again, we can ask for that during an exam or just in doing our analysis when the financial statements are filed with us. I will move to FCM and IB, net capital. Very common to see some form of the financial statement not being calculated properly, whether or not receivables are not secured, balances being reflected as a current asset when they shouldn't be, just where they're held, if it's a bank, you know, where the money is being maintained. Prepaid assets are never a current asset, always a non-current asset. Making sure you take the correct haircut charges for any balances that you are reflecting as current. Many of them do then require a corresponding charge or haircut when completing the net capital computation. The aging of receivables, this too, very common, especially when it comes to commission, not accruing for liabilities. Very common to see that, again, kind of that cash basis of accounting where the liabilities aren't being accrued right when they occur. Promotional material. This one, depending on the nature of the promotion material that you're providing, if you're going to include profit and loss discussion, it needs to be balanced. If you're going to include rates or returns, you do need to make the point that the disclaimer just went right through my head. Performance is not necessarily indicative of future results needs to be on the material. It should be around, near, or right by where you have this performance information. Never include misstatements of fact or anything that can be misleading within the promotion material. Keep it as accurate as it needs to be based on your firm's operations. And then there's hypothetical. If you're going to use hypothetical performance, you need to be very careful when presenting it. It needs to be clear, and it needs to include any material assumptions that are utilized when making this material. Examples would be your initial investment, the amount of fees that were charged, settlement rates, open and close values. So again, we could come in and recreate, or anyone that wanted to could come in and recreate that material if we wanted to do so. And any time you have rates or returns or anything, you need to keep, the support, whether it's the 12-column spreadsheet back in the day, that's the language you used, or anything that supports the rate of return calculation. And always remember, any performance information that you include in promo needs to be net of fees. Fees have to be factored in there. So now I'm going to go into the whole area just of supervision, which is where we see many violations just in all areas where supervision is required. I'm going to try not to go too detailed in certain areas because certain panels later today are going to go into it as well. But I guess starting off with supervision, you need to make sure you have clearly defined roles at your firm. Who is responsible for what and how they're going to be responsible for it. Then you need to have reviews and keep track of those reviews and your procedures on how you're going to review, how often you're going to do them, what's going to be reviewed, how you're going to document it, and then if the firm is following its procedures. If you're going to use entity-wide procedures, that of your parent or an affiliated company, you need to make sure two things. One, that your firm is factored into these procedures. You know, you're mentioned in there, and it's clear that these procedures were tailored to your business as well. You're not just grabbing your parents' procedures manual and following it when their procedures really don't line up to yours. So they need to be tailored to the operations that you're going to be doing. Supervision of APs at remote locations and at branch offices. So we'll do branch offices first. Those require an annual review. And there are on-site, an annual on-site review. There are situations or you can determine that you only need to physically go to the branch every other year, but again, there's criteria that need to be weighed and should be documented and maintained to show why that rationale was made and why you're only going every other year. Things to keep in mind, if something at that branch changes, if there's turnover, if there's a complaint, if something doesn't seem right, you should be going to that branch even in that off year and keeping track of this. Remote locations do not require the annual visit, and that's, again, more this hybrid people working from home. But that also means that anything that that office is doing, emails, whatever important documents, also need to be at the main office or need to be at the main office. And the main office is required to do ongoing supervision of that office, of that location, on a regular basis. Third-party service providers, which is a relatively new interpretive notice that we came out with a little over a year ago. Many members choose to outsource a large part of their responsibilities to a third-party provider, which is fine, but you need to keep procedures that go through the vetting process, the ongoing monitoring, supervising, overseeing the work that they do, because ultimately you're still responsible. So you can outsource and throw your hands in the air and say, that's not my responsibility anymore. So you do need to keep regular review of that. But the common deficiency that we see is more along the lines of no one has procedures. They didn't even put together any procedures yet with this being so new, or them just being incomplete, not having all the areas that they need to. ISSP, again, I know there's a whole other panel on this, but high level, we see that the firm is not following its own procedures. What I said earlier, the procedures aren't tailored to your firm. They're either an affiliate parent where they're not really capturing what is going on at your firm. Failure to be approved by supervisory personnel. These procedures that are in use, lessons learned aren't always incorporated, and an inadequate education and training program. So the interp requires that you receive training upon hire and then thereafter. That on hire is often forgotten. And then the getting it done every year, you need to be mindful. There needs to be separation of duties within the firm. That's clear to us. A common area we find here is pool funds often commingled either with firm money or other fund money at a firm. That needs to be all separated, and someone should be overseeing that process. Trade communication and record keeping. So with this, you need to keep full records of all transactions that your firm is doing. If required, all oral and written communication that the brokers are having with customers needs to be maintained. Common deficiencies that we see here is oral conversations are not being recorded. Chats are not being maintained. Cell phones are being used where either the firm is not even aware that the brokers are using cell phones, or they are and they're not recording them at all. And then maintaining those records for the required period of time is also. So we'll see firms that will record communications or will keep these chats, but keep them for 1 year instead of the five, or the oral, keep them for 2 weeks and then, you know, delete them and move and record more. You have to keep them for the right period of time. Failing to recognize when your recording system has failed. This is another common one. With ongoing monitoring and supervising, you should be checking this on the regular to make sure that your recordings are being maintained. It shouldn't take 6 months to a year for you to figure out, oops, you know, we don't have those recordings from all last summer. That's not going to work. So you need to be spot checking, making sure that your recordings are working properly. And then again, failure to implement and adopt procedures to review communication. So kind of what I said earlier, frequency of review, who's responsible for the review, how the review is going to be documented, and then any deficiencies that are noted and communicating that with whoever review, who's responsible for the review, how the review is going to be documented, and then any deficiencies that are noted and communicating that with whoever needs that to be communicated with. Another one we kind of see here a lot too is many times these brokers that are brokering trades are not registered as APs. So we're finding it very common that there's individuals that should be. And I'll go to one like kind of specific area, but we've seen more and more where there's, let's say, a foreign firm that we're examining who a broker is doing business with another foreign counterparty brokering a trade. And they'll say that this foreign broker doesn't need to be registered because this customer that they're brokering with is a foreign entity, foreign, so it's fine. When we drill down further, that customer is actually, let's say, a broker of JP Morgan, a U.S. entity. So the fact that he works for a U.S. entity requires that broker of our firm to be registered because he is doing business with a U.S. customer. So you really need to look further than just where the people you're dealing with reside, and more the companies that they work for and where that company is registered or located. Common overdue items that we find, and some of these I already hit, but the cybersecurity training and the annual review, the ethics training, all these need to be done calendar year. So you need to be mindful to keep track of all this stuff. The annual AML training, the annual independent audit for AML, the branch office inspections that I just went through, financial filings, whether it's IBFCM, I mean, those I think are at $1,000 a day now, every day that they're late. PQRs and PFSs, when they're late, they're $200 a day. We see those late often, as well as liquidation statements. And the self-exam questionnaire, where here's where I'm going to go on my rant a little bit. If you guys used the self-exam questionnaire, we have tailored that to really help you either completely avoid or lessen the amount of deficiencies that I just went through today. It's all in there. It's a step-by-step guide to help you set up procedures, enforce procedures, reminders on things to have done or do, to really help you avoid a lot of what I just went through there. There's appendices that help you create your AML procedures, your BCDR, Business Continuity and Disaster Recovery Plan, ethics training, privacy, and the third-party providers. It's all there. And when we come to you, we make sure you guys sign off on that attestation, which you often do, many times very late, but you do it. But if you really use that review, so you wouldn't have these violations. That's all that I had. Does anyone have any questions? Joe, how do you want to?
Yeah, I'll get
Okay. Maybe I'll see.
For the required archiving of communications, is there a specific file formatting that the NFA prefers or requires, like an MP3 recording for a call, for example?
No. I mean, I'm not super techie to be able to answer that, but I know any firm that we've done, however, I don't know if you have a specific one where I could find out for you, but I haven't encountered an issue yet.
Good morning. A question about branch offices. If you have an office in Florida, let's say, which isn't uncommon after COVID, where you do have several of your employees gathering, so it's a rented space, but nothing happens there except these individuals come into the office. They work, if they were at home, they would be using the same network system because it's all work remotely. There's no meetings with clients. There's no other activity other these folks get together and sit and work. How would the NFA view that from an examination standpoint? And from internal audit standpoint?
The way that it's our interpretive notice is written is that is a...
View that from an examination standpoint. And from internal audit standpoint.
The way that it's our interpretive notice is written is that is a branch office. So the remote location is purely... And it can be a rented space, but it's one person or maybe a husband and wife, father and son that work together. If you're going to have a group of APs in that one location, I mean, you're certainly going to have to do the on. I would see it as this. That's a branch where you will keep track of what's going on there. So your on-site monitoring and maybe your scope of what needs to be reviewed there then is way less than a branch that's fully functional, that meets customers and everything. But for registration-wise, to me, that's a branch. But I would think less supervision would be required when you tailor your procedures to supervise that location. I don't know if anyone disagrees with me. Okay. Just want to make sure all that everybody was with me.
Hi. For new firms that are existing, what's the typical period of time that we can expect an exam to go back and review?
Are you asking, as a new member, how long before we come do an exam of you?
Well, I guess so.
Oh, or how much our exam period while we're there?
Yeah, so I asked that because when you talked about the financial ratios, you were clear that it was a 12-month period. But for an exam, what period of time could we expect the exam to cover?
It certainly depends on the scope. based on your operations, based on what information, you know, why we're coming, what we know, what we've seen. So there isn't a one answer, but we're not going to do years of review of you. I mean, the financial side's different than the compliance side. And like I said, it depends on what we see. You are required to maintain most records for 5 years. Don't hold me to this, but typically within that year of when we come. But I'm not going to say that that's all the time.
Thank you. So my question is on the topic of logging communications. There's a requirement, at least where I work, that internal audit has chief audit executive approval for recording communications. So is there an expectation from the NFA to obtain that approval from a chief audit executive to have those recorded conversations?
You mean this person's approving what? That they've been recorded?
During an internal audit examination, yes. So when the NFA has their exams, is there some sort of requirement to obtain approval to have conversations, have recorded conversations?
No. And maybe I'm not following you, but approval from us for you to have those? Like, I'm not exactly sure I'm following.
Got it. I guess, yeah, that was my question.
There's no required approval. We just want you, you're allowed to have them, and when you have them, you need to record them.
Okay.
And whoever is responsible for overseeing that, making sure that they are recorded. Because we will want to know who's responsible for that, who's responsible for making sure they're recorded, reviewing them, supervising them, ongoing. We will want to know all of that. So maybe at your firm it's required to then have someone designated as that person.
Got it.
Because we will want to know.
Great. Thank you.
Just a real question, a quick question, just some clarification on APs and supervisors. I don't really think I fully understood what you were saying as to a supervisor and their direct line. If you're not client facing as a supervisor, but you do have a team below you, do you still need to be registered as an AP slash principal?
So if you have
anything like that.
But if they are registered as associated persons, if you chose to register them as associated persons and you supervise them, you yourself need to be an associated person as well.
Not specifically a principal.
Hello. Hi. question about recording conversations with clients. If a client contacts an AP on an unrecorded device, cell phone or some other method, and leaves a message or before the AP can advise the client not to speak on that device, but provides order information, what is the NFA's advice on how that AP should then handle that situation?
Well, I would personally say it would depend if a client is going to be reaching out to an individual. To potentially broker a trade, or would expect that device would be recorded. You know, that client would have their phone number or some sort of medium to contact them. I would expect that would be in place, that would be recorded.
Right. But
if there was an instance where it wasn't recorded, I mean, they would have to do their whatever it is necessary to record that. If it's potentially to forward it, the message, you know, somehow to capture that message if it's a one-off. But if they could potentially receive information, then I would expect that to be recorded. I don't know if you want to.
I'm just going to give advice. It sounds to me like you're saying this is after the fact. This was found. You found this recording on a voicemail on a cell phone.
Well,
or the broker came forward and told you.
Yeah, the trader is out of the office and only has their cell phone and is friends with the AP and calls him or her on that device, just has that number available, doesn't have their work number, doesn't have IM access, which so much business is done on IM now, and so that communication happens there. Not that our AP wants it to happen there, but that's how it happens. It's not out of control of the AP to to prevent this individual from doing this, you know, what, that we have advised then there to move the conversation to a recorded device as soon as possible, but that this happens, I mean, is there anything we, other than what's been suggested about trying to record that, in these situations, what, you know, is there anything, any advice you guys can give us on how we should deal with that?
My advice initially would be you need to make it stop because we don't have a lot of, there's not a lot of room. We don't give a lot of room here. In that, there's not a lot of room. We don't give a lot of room here. In that situation, if it's after the fact, I would certainly, I would hope that that broker would have instructed the customer to then call the office so it does go online where there is a recorded call then for that transaction that can then be maintained. I would probably suggest that your firm then do like a holistic review to make sure that this isn't happening on the regular.
Yes, indeed.
You know, and provide, you know, have evidence that that was done, because we do find this. When we do our testing, we find a one-off, you know, hey, call me or whatever, where we can tell this conversation either started on an unrecorded line or moved to an unrecorded line. And I'm just saying, this is what I do now every day. This is the group that I'm in. There's not a lot of slack given in this area. So if you've seen it once, I think what we would want to see is that you guys really clamp down and somehow instilled procedures, either started recording cell phone lines, prohibiting these lines and making it very clear that there's a penalty for using these lines, something that ups provision of this and the use of this that makes it clear to us that you took the next step.
Hello. Hey, Cheryl. Have there been an instance or instances where the NFA had to go to a remote location to investigate or respond or to see if there's anything that was done that was really not correct or clear from a supervisory home office?
Point? Not that I am aware of yet. Are you guys aware of any in Chicago? Yeah, we're not. I mean, I would certainly say that doesn't mean that we won't if necessary, especially if there is registered individuals at that location, but not that I'm aware of.
Thank you.
You mentioned that prior to any exam that the RMG group assesses or tries to identify key risk areas. As a matter of policy or practice, is that something that is made available to the member firms prior to the exam, or that's something that's kept quite close to the chest of the examiners?
For the most part, I would say, in most instances, I would say it's not really disclosed because it could be a lot of numerous factors. If there's one driving force, a lot of customer complaints, then I think it's going to be obvious because we're going to be going asking numerous questions surrounding a specific area. But there's, in most instances, there's a lot of different factors that come into play. And when they compile this data, that's how they prioritize it. So unless there's that one driving force that makes it obvious during the exam, and you would be able to figure it out yourself, but we're not going to really disclose why. I've never disclosed why.
I'm sorry, just another quick question surrounding platforms that we're using or firms could possibly using to communicate with their clients. We've seen a lot of cases come out on WhatsApp. Can you, not sure if you can or not, tell us what platforms you're seeing that has potential issues? I know you can't tell us what to do and what not to do, or what platforms to get on, but anything that you're seeing from any kind of industry across the regulatory scape that we should be looking into if we're looking at a specific platform. Just wanted to see if you guys had an idea.
I honestly can't recall anywhere where, I don't mean to say it this way, but that the issue was like platform, anywhere where, I don't mean to say it this way, but that the issue was like platform related. There certainly was, and I don't recall, one where I think the company may have moved a location, meaning the member firm moved a location where the platform, the recording backup didn't pick up properly when they moved, but I'm not really sure whose fault that was. So I guess my short answer is I'm not aware of any platform that anyone is using that hasn't worked to retain what's needed to be retained.
So I'll piggyback on that. If you're having clients, and I'll put that out there, farmers per se, or you have counterparties that are from other countries that have remote access to anything, what are you saying to your firm members who may have some difficulties in capturing that information? Most farmers out there, they're using either, put China, WeChat, or out of Brazil, WhatsApp, or other platforms that may not be something that we're used to here in the U.S. Are you guys putting anything together or any thoughts around what clients?
Typically, NFA doesn't recommend or promote a vendor or a third party in any way. That's just not typically something we do. I don't really know how to answer that. I mean, I certainly see a lot of the WeChat, the Bloomberg, the ICE. I mean, those are the more common ones. I haven't seen any that I really aren't too familiar with. But putting it specifically to overseas, and I really don't know. But I will say, we more than likely would never put something out that suggests, recommends a certain vendor. I think we stopped that 30 years ago, whatever, where we used to just provide a list of ethics training providers, which we don't even do that anymore.
And the only other thing that I would add is that I've heard recently that there's different tiers of record retention. So just make sure that you select the when you subscribe to whatever service that it meets the criteria for retention.